Trib Live Radio presents Off-Road Politics from Main Street to the Beltway with Selena Zito, reporter at the Pittsburgh Trib. Trib Total Media, see what's next. Now, here's your host, Selena Zito.
Hi, welcome back to Off-Road Politics. I'm Selena Zito, reporter and columnist at the Pittsburgh Tribune Review. And in the studio with me today is my colleague and friend and author, Andrew Conte. And Andrew, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me on.
The last time I had you on, we talked about cybersecurity and all kinds of dark, scary stuff, right?
Yeah, it's still out there. So.
Yeah. I mean, that's sort of Andy's thing. But his other thing is writing really great books about these figures that have this impact in our city, in Pittsburgh. And, you know, and sort of that impact has that pool effect where it affects the rest of the country. And today we're talking about your new book. It's called The Color of Sundays, The Secret Strategy That Built the Steelers Dynasty. So it wasn't just luck then, right? I mean, the Steelers just didn't get lucky in the 70s and be like, oh, okay, we're going to start winning every Super Bowl.
Yeah, no, it might have looked like that, but there was, definitely a lot of hard work behind
plan.
It. People actually, worked really hard at it.
And the central figure in your book is Bill Nunn Jr. He's an athlete, he was a reporter, and he became a famed, trusted confidant and scout for the Steelers. At a time when the Steelers, I mean, you're too young to remember this, but they really stunk before this sort of secret strategy happened. Let's first talk about Mr. Nunn.
Yeah, I'm definitely part of that blessed generation that grew up, like from the earliest memories I have of the Steelers winning Super Bowls and, you know, going on and, you know, totally dominating the NFL.
Well, so. My earliest memories are them playing in Forbes Field.
Right.
And never winning. I mean, they were just hapless. There was just, but, you know, it's still, you know, back then Pittsburgh was known as a baseball town, but that's an unfair title to give it because we still loved our football. I mean, there has been this culture of that sort of Friday Night Lights thing in Western Pennsylvania where football dominates and it begins on a Friday night and goes all the way through Sunday. Pitt was through the years, it was much better than the Steelers were, especially in the 60s and early 70s. And Western Pennsylvania football has always had these sort of great figures that come out of there. You look at Joe Montana, Joe Namath, what's the guy who owns, who played for Chicago and was the coach at Chicago? Do you know who I'm talking about?
Right.
Yep. And we can't think of his name. Okay.
That was terrible.
Yeah, that was awful, but that's me. So let's talk a little bit about Bill Nunn Jr. Who is this guy?
Mike Ditka is what you're
going for. Yeah, Mike Ditka. There we are. Yeah. You win.
So Bill Nunn Jr. was somebody who grew up ensconced in, Pittsburgh celebrity. His father was the managing editor of the Pittsburgh Courier at a time when the Courier was the nation's preeminent black newspaper. And it's hard for people to understand that today, what that really meant. But this was
a big deal.
A paper with 14 editions, 14 offices around the country. They had reporters in Seattle and Los Angeles and Miami and Chicago and New York and all these places. And all of their information would come back to Pittsburgh. They would put out the paper and they would send it out. And for people who lived in rural America, for blacks who lived in rural America, this was often their only way, their best way to get information about the outside world.
Absolutely.
So Bill Nunn Jr. grew up in a family. His father was the managing editor, and so he was surrounded by this. And so every time there were black celebrities, athletes, entertainers, Count Basie or, some of the early boxers, Joe Louis, whenever they would come through town, they would stop at the Nunn household. And so they were all there. And Nunn sort of grew up just with the expectation that this was no big deal and that it was also, important to have that broader perspective. And so he goes on and he has all these opportunities himself. He becomes, he's a pioneering athlete. He was, made a mark at Westinghouse High School on the team there. And he went to West Virginia State and played on the team there. They went undefeated that season. They were the only undefeated team in the country. But they were all black, and
right.
So they weren't allowed to play against the national champions.
What year was this?
This was 1946.
Right. So, football at that point.
This was basketball.
Basketball.
Basketball
at that point was still not integrated.
Nothing was. It was interesting. I mean, people know the story of baseball. Right. You know, they've all seen 42, and they know Jackie Robinson, right, integrated baseball. People don't really realize that football has its own troubled past when it comes to race. The professional football had black players originally. Initially, in around the 1900s, there were black players. The first was in 1904. But then in 1933, the NFL owners got together and removed all the blacks from the league. And it's not clear whether it was where they actually got together and said, we're going to do this, or they just got together and did it.
Yeah.
But they did it. There were no blacks from 1933 till after the Second World War, until 1946. And so it was an all-white league. And if you were a talented black athlete coming out of college, the best thing you could hope for was to get your name in the Pittsburgh Courier, to be named as one of the top All-Americans from a black college that year. And so that was Nunn's job, to go and find the best black college football players. And so it was only then, 1946, Nunn gets out of college and he decides to he wants to be a sports reporter. And this becomes his job. And he's coming out at the same time that, you know, post-war years, the blacks are finally starting to get a chance to play. The Cleveland Rams moved from Cleveland to Los Angeles. And when they moved out there, they wanted to use the L.A. Coliseum. And so the Coliseum Commission was having a meeting about whether to allow this to happen. And the Pittsburgh Courier sent a reporter. They had a reporter in Los Angeles, and he went to the meeting and said, look, if you're going to have a team here, you should at least let black players at least try out for the team. And so they convinced the owner that that's what they should do. And so the L.A. Rams were the first team to reintegrate the league then that year. They pulled
and
in.
And that year was?
1946. It was the year before baseball integrated. For the first time. And then but it was interesting because, you know, so Jackie Robinson integrated baseball. On the football side, it was two guys who had played with him at UCLA. They all played football together. So Kenny Washington and Woody Strode were the first to integrate the NFL. And at the same time, there was the All-American Football Conference had just started, and the Cleveland Browns were there, and Paul Brown brought blacks onto his team. And so both leagues were integrated the same year.
That's great. Now, okay, so let's fast forward. He has this whole entire career covering American sports.
Right.
Right? I mean, he's, you know, very accomplished, very celebrated career. And then what does he do?
Yeah, so, I mean, as Nunn always told me, he was like, you know, I had a whole lifetime before coming to the Steelers, but... You know, and he'd written all these stories. He was the first black reporter to sit in the press box at Forbes Field. You know, he did some of the early reporting on Jackie Robinson, the other first blacks in baseball, from the stands. Before he was allowed to sit in the press box, he had to sit in the stands and wait for them outside of the stadium because he wasn't allowed to go to the locker room. By the 1960s, he was allowed in the locker room and in the press box. And after the Game 7 of the 1960 World Series, he's the one that drives Clemente to the airport. Nunn then does a bunch of groundbreaking work on exposing segregation at training camp, which, you know, it's like another thing that you don't even think about today. But, you know, in the 1960s, these teams would go down to Florida and Georgia and the South, and, you know, they would go from playing together in Pittsburgh. You know, Nunn goes down and talks to the black players on the Pirates. They've just been named, you know, they've just won the world championship. And they get down there, and the black players can't stay with the white players. You know, they have to stay across town in somebody's house. And, you know, so Nunn really exposes the injustices that are going on there.
Well, it makes you think of, you know, all those stories that you grew up with hearing about Sammy Davis Jr. when he played with Frank Sinatra and Dean Martin. You know, they would do these great Vegas shows, but he had to go in a separate entrance. He had to stay at a separate hotel. And finally, Sinatra just put his foot down and said, wait a minute, this can't happen. This is not going to happen, or I'm not going to play there. And it's those tiny little instances that start to make a cultural change. It's always, it's never any one big thing, but it's always a bunch of different things spread out all across in different parts of our society. So how does Nunn then end up with the Steelers?
Yeah, so every year he puts together this black college football All-America team. And in the mid-1960s, he decides to start holding a banquet for the players in Pittsburgh, because every year before that, he would just do the list and put it out, and that was it. So he starts bringing in all these best players to Pittsburgh. They have a fancy dinner at the Hilton downtown. And of course, he needs sponsors to put that on. And Royal Crown Cola was one of the first sponsors, but he also needed additional money. So he got the Rooneys to kick in some support as well. And the Rooney family, the, you know, Art Sr., the chief, and his sons are going to the game, to the events every year, to the banquet. They're sitting there and they're saying, you know, our team is, this is one point where Ambassador Rooney, Dan Rooney, his point of contention was that the Steelers weren't terrible. They were only mediocre but at that point. But, you know, but they'd made the playoffs one time and they lost. And so they were a team that had not had much success. And they're sitting there saying, you know, we haven't had any success and there are all these talented athletes. Why don't we know about these black players? And so Dan Rooney got the idea to hire Bill Nunn, and he called him up and said, you know, will you come down and meet with us? The team headquarters were at the Roosevelt Hotel across from Heinz Hall downtown. And so Bill Nunn came down and Dan said, you know, we'd love for you to come to work for us. And Nunn said, not interested. don't want to do it.
Because he knew they were the worst team in football.
Yeah, no, he ticked off the reasons, you know, that they hadn't treated him well, hadn't let him sit in the press box, hadn't paid attention to all the lists he'd put out in the years before, you know, there were some other teams that had started to look at Nunn's list and draft some of those players, and the Steelers, when they had done that, they hadn't done well. They had drafted a black quarterback named Roy Curry, and then their coach, Buddy Parker, wouldn't let Roy play quarterback, and he made him play wide receiver, and he went out and got injured, and that was the end of his career. So Nunn cited all those things, and the Rooneys were adamant that they were intending to change their ways. They wanted to really work with him and do something different. And so Nunn agrees to do it, and then he has a meeting that night with Art Rooney Jr., so Dan's brother, who is director of personnel. And Art Jr. was terrific. It was a great interview. He really put himself in the moment of meeting Nunn for the first time. And at the end of their discussion, he says to Nunn, you know, well, he says, what? I think prejudice is a good thing. Nunn's like, you know, what are you talking about? And Art Jr. says, well, if the rest of the league remains prejudiced and we don't, then that's a real advantage for us.
Oh, wow.
So, yeah.
Wow. That's really powerful.
Yeah.
And right. Also probably a really awkward moment, right?
The fact is those guys, what I loved about them was that they didn't allow any of those moments to be awkward. They just got past them and they, you know, they really just agreed that they were going to not get hung up on those awkward discussions about race that often trip us up in American society, you know.
Well, I'm not going to make you reveal everything in the book. I highly recommend everybody read it. I read it, I think, in 3 days. I couldn't put it down. It's so good. I can't wait till the movie comes out because it's going to be amazing. But one of the things that I loved about the book is the backstory of how you got to talk to Mr. Nunn.
Right. So when when I learned about him, I didn't know anything about him, and Mark Hart, the development director for the Steelers, said, hey, you should do a book on Bill Nunn. I was like, I don't know who that is. He started telling me his story, and I was like, yeah, that's a great story. I would love to do that book. And so I tried to reach out to Bill Nunn. I tried calling him on the phone. I sent him a handwritten note. He just wouldn't respond. And so I then went to Ambassador Rooney with your help. I think you helped me connect with him. And then I also talked to Kevin Colbert, the general manager of the team, and I told him what I wanted to do. And they both agreed. They said, you know, that's a great story. And so they kind of leaned on Nunn and said, you know, you should do this. You need to tell him your stories. So I went to Nunn and I said, he finally agreed to meet with me.
Where did you guys meet?
We met at his house. He lived up in the Hill District near where there's a blue water tower at the top of the Hill District.
Yep.
And it's in the middle of a park, and that's where
Used to be called Goat Hill back in the turn of the 19th century. Just a piece of useless information because everybody sent their goats up there.
That water tower sort of haunted me then. You know, we can see it from the Tribune Review, from our offices. You can see it from Mount Washington, from Oakland, from everywhere. You can see this blue water tower, and it was like,
that's it.
I got to finish this story because that water tower is going to haunt me.
Yes.
So I met him at his house, and he just said he didn't, you know, he's like, you're not going to do a book on me. And I was like, oh, okay. But I kept talking with him, and you know, I really realized that I needed to get his stories down because they were going to be lost. And what Nunn really was trying to tell me was he didn't want a book just about him. He wanted a book about all the guys who had stood with him and worked with him. You know, his father's generation and, you know, the people at the Courier who had worked so hard and, you know, the other athletes that had come before and come after and, you know, the guys he played with. You know, he played in high school with Chuck Cooper, who was the first black drafted in the NBA. Played in college with Earl Lloyd, who was the first black to play in the NBA. You know, he wanted me to do that larger story, that richer story. And so I went back to him then and I said, you know, all right, now who's the book about? And I gave him some names and he's like, all right, that's fine. But, you know, he started throwing out more names and he just kept telling me more and more of these people. And it was interesting as I was reporting on the book, you know, I would talk with these people like Earl Lloyd, the first black. I called him up on the phone and he answered his phone, which is great. And I said, do you have time to talk? He's like, you better catch me while I'm hot. And so I did the interview. It was great. We talked for about 20-30 minutes and he had these fantastic stories. He talked about how he grew up in Virginia and, you know, he lived in a black community, black schools, went to West Virginia State, black school, hadn't really even had a conversation with a white person until he graduated from college and got drafted into the NBA. And that was a terrific story. And then after he started in the NBA, he got drafted to go fight in the military in Korea. And so he just had these really terrific stories and it was great, got him down. And then during the process of the book, he died. And that kept happening to me. The lot of the characters I interviewed, these were their last interviews that they gave.
Wow, including Nunn.
Yeah, so Bill Nunn then died in the reporting of this. He was 89 years old and totally caught me off guard. I didn't think he would ever die. He was just so robust and that lively, and he was going to work every day. He was in the draft room getting ready for the Steelers draft 2 years ago when he had a stroke, and a week later he died in the hospital on the eve of the draft. And it meant a lot to the guys on the team, the other scouts. They actually still have the tables that they had at the Roosevelt Hotel. They moved them from there to Three River Stadium, and now they have them at their headquarters in the South Side. And the tables have ash marks on them from Art Jr. cigars and from Bill Nunn cigarettes, where the ashes dropped and they have little marks on the tables. And so they still have those tables. They're not the main tables they used, but...
But they have preserved them. Having worked for the Steelers, I knew that. And having met Mr. Nunn several times, it's hard to describe just how charismatic and charming this man was in a very unique way. But what were your impressions of him? Because I just loved him. I just thought the world of him.
Yeah, just very understated. You know, he didn't want any attention. That's why he didn't want a book about him. He didn't want the attention, didn't want the glory. He was more about all the other people around him. Yeah. So,
well, how can people find your book, Andy?
So they can go to thecolorofsundays.com. They can see my blog at andrewconte.com.
That's A-N-D-R-E-W-C-O-N-T-E.
Right, E at the end. And it's also available through Amazon, Barnes & Noble, independent retailers around.
And how can people follow you on Twitter?
So, yeah, my handle is at Andrew Conte.
And you can also, you have a Facebook page for The Color of Sundays. People can engage with you there. They can talk to you about the book, ask you questions, order tons of them, right?
Yeah, and Twitter as well. The book has its own Twitter handle, Color of Sundays.
That's great. I highly recommend this book, The Color of Sundays by Andrew Conte. You can follow Andy on Twitter. It's at A-N-D-R-E-W-C-O-N-T-E. You can find The Color of Sundays on Amazon. You can find it on his homepage, andrewconte.com. And there's also a... Does The Color of Sundays have its own website, mm-hmm. too? Yeah, that's right. Andy, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me on.
Thanks. Bye.